Kay, and you're listening to For Land's Sake. I'm your host, Bill Kite. Today our guest is Edward Abbey, who can't be with us, literally, so we will listen to his words. No, it's not in recognition of his death in March of 1989, nor his birth on January 29th, 1927. Today we are celebrating the legacy he left us, his call to action from our armchair complacency. My first encounter with Cactus Ed was in the mid-1970s through his words accompanying Elliot Porter's pictures in Appalachian Wilderness, the Great Smoky Mountains. Next was Desert Solitaire and As Many People, the book to start with to learn about Ed Abbey. The book, Ed told us, was not primarily about the desert. He said, "In recording my impressions of the natural scene, I have striven above all for accuracy, since I believe that there is a kind of poetry, even a kind of truth in simple fact. But the desert is a vast world, an oceanic world, as deep in its ways and complex and various as the sea. Language makes a mighty loose net with which to go fishing for simple facts when facts are infinite. If a man knew enough, he could write a whole book about the juniper tree. Not juniper trees in general, but that one particular juniper tree, which grows from a ledge of naked sandstone near the old entrance to Arches National Monument. What I've tried to do, then, is something a bit different. Since you cannot get the desert into a book any more than a fisherman can haul up the sea with his nets, I've tried to create a world of words in which the desert figures more as a medium than as material. Not imitation, but evocation has been the goal. My kind of writer, reactionary, radical when needed, for the protection of our planet. While visiting Bisbee, Arizona recently with my partner, Kate, she bought me a paperback copy of Abbey's novel Black Sun. There was a photo for sale of Ed there at the bookstore, standing in all his glory with a mischievous smile on his face. It was for sale at a decent price, but I did not buy it. This appreciation I'm doing today of him comes not from any hero worship, nor is it from a cult following. It's because his words matter. His words move me. These words. From Beyond the Wall. On a float trip in Alaska. "Quiet," whispers Mark, resting on the oars. "Look over there." We look where he points. Three wolves are watching us from another bar beside the river, less than 100 feet away. Three great gray shaggy wolves, backlit by the low sun, staring at us. Silently, we drift closer. Gently, Mark pulls the boat onto the gravel where it stops. "Don't get out," Mark whispers. The wolves watch. The cameras come out. The wolves start to move away into the willow thicket and toward the open tundra. A whistle stops the last one as it climbs the bank. I stare at the wolf through my binoculars. The wolf stares at me. For one still, frozen, sacred moment, I see the wild green fire in its eyes. Then it shrugs, moves, vanishes. The wild green fire in its eyes comes from Aldo Leopold's seminal life-changing experience of realizing what he had done when he shot a wolf. Both Abbey's and Leopold's experiences with wildness in the wilderness are powerful enough when shared to move us if we ourselves are willing to care about untrammeled land. Abbey again. Why the surly hatred of progress and development, the curlish resistance to all popular improvements? Very well, a fair question. But it's been asked and answered 1,000 times already. Enough books to drive a man stark naked mad have dealt in detail with the question. There are many answers, all good, each sufficient. Peace is often mentioned. Beauty, spiritual refreshment, whatever that means. Recreation for the soul, whatever that is. Escape, novelty, the delight of something different. Truth and underlying understanding and wisdom. Commendable virtues in any man, any time. Ecology and all that, meaning the salvation of variety, diversity, possibility, and potentiality, the preservation of the genetic reservoir, the answers to questions that we have not yet even learned to ask, a connection to the origin of things, an opening into the future, a source of sanity for the present. All true, all wonderful, all more than enough to answer such a dumb, dead, degrading question as, why wilderness? To which, nevertheless, I shall amend and append one further answer anyway. Because we like the taste of freedom. Because we like the smell of danger. His writing in Down the River appeals to our shared humanity. And that in itself sometimes is enough. From Floating. Each precious moment entails every other. Each sacred place suggests the imminent presence of all places. Each man, each woman exemplifies all humans. The bright faces of my companions here now on this Rio Dolores, this river of sorrows, somewhere in the melodramatic landscape of southwest Colorado, break my heart. For in their faces, eyes, vivid bodies in action, I see the hope and joy and tragedy of humanity everywhere. Just as the hermit thrush singing its trinody, back in the piney gloom of the forest, speaks for the lost and voiceless everywhere. What am I trying to say? The same as before. Everything. Nothing more than that. Everything implied by water, motion, rivers, boats, by the floating. He tells us, I come more and more to the conclusion, really, that wilderness in America, or anywhere else, is the only thing left that is worth saving. And the idea of wilderness needs no defense, it only needs defenders. And I, myself here, I wonder, does that include you listening and me? His words written 40 years ago in The Journey Home are prophetic for what we are seeing in America today. I read, as I see it, our nation, our own nation, is not free from the danger of dictatorship, and I refer to internal as well as external threats to our liberties. As social conflict tends to become more severe in this country, and it will unless we strive for social justice, there will inevitably be a tendency on the part of the authoritarian element always present in our history to suppress individual freedoms, to utilize the refined techniques of police surveillance, not excluding torture, of course, in order to preserve not wilderness, but the status quo, the privileged positions of those who now so largely control the economic and governmental institutions of the United States. Sound familiar today? Not everyone likes Cactus Ed's sharp tongue. In Postcards from Ed, Dispatches and Salvos from an American Iconoclast, Abby writes a letter responding to an unfriendly editorial about the book, The Monkey Ranch Gang. I read, "As for that book, please note that The Monkey Ranch Gang is a novel, a work of fiction, and I like to think a work of art. It would be naive to read it as a tract, a program for action, or a manifesto. The book is a comedy with a happy ending. It was written to entertain, to inspire tears and laughter, to amuse my friends and aggravate our enemies, aggravate their ulcers. So far, about 500,000 readers seem to have found that approach appealing. The book does not condone terrorism in any form. Let's have some precision in language here. Terrorism means deadly violence for a political and or economic purpose, carried out against people and other living things, and is usually conducted by governments against their own citizens, as at Kent State, or in Vietnam, or in Poland, or in most of Latin America right now, or by corporate entities such as J. Paul Getty, Exxon Mobil Oil, etc., etc., against the land and all creatures that depend upon the land for life and livelihood. A bulldozer ripping up a hillside to strip mine for coal is committing terrorism. The damnation of a flowing river following the drowning of Cherokee graves of forest and farmland is an act of terrorism." Then Abby goes on to say a little bit about sabotage. He says, "Sabotage, on the other hand, means the use of force against inanimate property, such as machinery, which is being used to deprive human beings of their rightful work, for whatever purpose, has never meant and has never implied the use of violence against living creatures. The characters in Monkey Ranch engage in industrial sabotage in order to defend a land they love against industrial terrorism. They do this only when it appears that in certain cases and places all other means of defense of land and life have failed, and that force, the final resort, becomes morally justified. Not only justified, but a moral obligation, as in the defense of one's own life, one's own family, one's own home, one's own nature, against a violent assault. Such is the basis of my character's rationale in the Monkey Ranch Gang. How the reader chooses to interpret all this is the reader's business." And so, Cactus Ed tells it like it is. Those pedantically erudite critics back east didn't care for Cactus Ed either, as shown in Doug Peacock's comments on his foreword to The Best of Ed Abbey, Best of Edward Abbey. He writes that Black Sun is a sexy novel to which Abbey remained loyal despite the scorn of the Eastern literary establishment. In the author's preface to his own book, In the Best of Edward Abbey, we find him lamenting the fact that his books are not reviewed by major Eastern publications. He says, "Each of my books, each defenseless child, has been met with a sublime, monumental, crashing silence, a freezing silence, when not ignored. My books are greatly greeted with what I must recognize as a coolness verging on outright frigidity." What I like about Abbey is he describes places that I've been to, places that matter to me, such as Bear's Ears in Utah. I fought a fire there once years ago in a previous lifetime, and then I realized what a beautiful place, what a threatened place Bear's Ears was and still is. Threatened now more than before, when President Obama and every president before him since Theodore Roosevelt used the Antiquities Act of 1906 to protect Bears Ears by setting it aside as a national monument. Now, Bears Ears is sort of like a magnet. It's attracting those kind of people that think any government control of land is anathema. They think that it's their land and theirs alone to do with as they see fit. But in reading about places that Abby has been to or places that he really likes, they just happen to be places I've been to and places I also like. Whether it's the Blue Mountains close by on the northwest, as he writes about a friend's cabin, or the San Juans to the east in Colorado, Sleeping Ute Mountain, Shiprock in the Chuscas, and Monument Valley in the Navajo Nation, Comb Ridge and Cedar Mesa, and the Bears Ears Buttes to the west and southwest. On a clear day, you can see all the way to Navajo Mountain, 100 miles by line of sight. And then sometimes, you know, he finds a way of reminding us that we ourselves may be part of the problem if we're not part of the solution. He says, maybe we should all stay home for a season, give our little western wilderness some relief from the Vibram soles, rubber boats, hang gliders, deer rifles, and fly rods. But where is home? Surely not the walled-in prison of the cities under that low ceiling of carbon monoxide and nitrogen oxides and acid rain, the leaky malaise of an overdeveloped, overcrowded, self-destroying civilization where most people are compelled to serve their time and please the wardens if they can. For many, for more and more of us, the out-of-doors is our true ancestral estate. For a mere 5,000 years, we've grubbed in the soil and laid brick upon brick to build the cities. But for a million years before that, we lived the leisurely, free, and adventurous life of hunters and gatherers, warriors and tamers of horses. How can we pluck that deep root of feeling from the racial consciousness? Impossible. When in doubt, jump out. Then he sometimes is able to write about things and people and landscapes, showing his own warts, his humanness, his vulnerabilities. Sometimes when describing someone else, it sounds much like he's describing himself. Except for journeys to France, Switzerland, Greece, and Crete, he has lived and worked ever since in the highlands of New Mexico and Utah, God's country and the artist's. 30 years of hectic marriages, 4 children, 2 deaths in the family, troubles and accidents have not diminished his appetite for love, nature, life. Nor has the relative obscurity of his professional career. He makes little effort to show or promote his work, dimmed his enthusiasm for the craft and the passion of his art. He continues to paint as steadily, earnestly, furiously as before, with an ever-growing boldness and simplicity. Not so much for the glory of it, glory is fleeting, as for the joy in the act itself and for the satisfaction in the object created. His writing shines when he writes about real things, real people, real landscapes in a dream-like way. And of course, that's how a lot of his writing comes across. It's almost like you're with him there dreaming, are dreaming about being with him. Here he says, in Down the River Again, I dream of a country church in Appalachia, painted white, shaded by giant white oaks. There's a graveyard on the hillside nearby, most of the headstones at least a century old. Some of the graves are marked with rusted iron stars and standards that carry the shafts of tiny, faded American flags. The stars bear the initials G-A-R, Grand River, Grand Army of the Republic, that is. Roots and branches of the family tree. My 3 brothers and I are marching through the woods, rifles on our shoulders. It seems to be autumn. The dead leaves rattle beneath our feet. We march swiftly, easily, without effort, without fear, toward a jealously, joyously desired but unimaginable fulfillment. There are other men with us ahead, behind, on both sides. We all march easily, swiftly, without effort, without speaking, toward the lights and glimmer off and on, the lights that glimmer like summer lightning, beyond the trees, beyond the dark ridge ahead. No one speaks. We move swiftly, easily. Abby is real to me. I can identify with him, with his words, with his humanity. In his book, The Best of Edward Abbey, he asked this question. Where have all the years gone? Why into the usual vices of the romantic realist, into sloth and melancholy, each feeding upon and reinforcing the other, into love and marriage and the begetting of children, into the strenuous maneuvers of earning a living without living to earn, into travel and play and music and drink and talk and laughter, into saving the world, but saving the world was only a hobby, into watching cloud formations float across planetary skies, but mostly into sloth and melancholy, and I don't regret a moment of it. So what is the job for those of us left behind, for those of us who care about the land? Again, in Ed's words, our job is to record, each in his own way, this world of light and shadow and time that will never come again exactly as it is today. I think of Ed when I'm in Canyonlands, and he writes from Desert Solitaire. We drive the dirt roads and walk out some of the trails. Everything is lovely and wild with a virginal sweetness. The arches themselves, strange, impressive, grotesque, form but a small and inessential part of the general beauty of this country. When we think of rock, we usually think of stones, broken rock, buried under soil and plant life. But here, all is exposed and naked, dominated by the monolithic formations of sandstone which stand above the surface of the ground and extend for miles, sometimes level, sometimes tilted or warped by pressures from below, carved by erosion and weathering into intricate maze of glens, grottos, fissures, passageways, and narrow, deep, narrow canyons. And then, from Desert Solitaire again, something I can really relate to whenever I'm around a campfire burning juniper. The fire, the odor of burning juniper is the sweetest fragrance on the face of the earth, in my honest judgment. I doubt if all the smoking censers of Dante's paradise could equal it. One breath of juniper smoke, like the perfume of sagebrush after rain, evokes in magical cataclysms, like certain music, the space and light and clarity and piercing strangeness of the American West. Long shall it burn. Abbey's still with us in his words, the words he's left us in the many books he's written. It's time we looked again at Edward Abbey's words, for the time we live in now is a dangerous time, as it was when Abbey himself was writing about it, maybe even more dangerous. So, what is both necessary and sufficient for honest work, he says, is to have faith in the evidence of your senses and in your common sense, to be true to your innate sense of justice, to be loyal to your family, your clan, your friends, and your community. Let the nation-state go hang itself. Stand up for the stupid and crazy. Love the earth and the sun and the animals. Read Walt Whitman, Mark Twain, Henry Thoreau, Jack London. And then, after mentioning a few other people, he says, that about covers it so far. Lastly, we find in The Black Sun, this world is very quiet, almost silent. The clear song of the hermit thrush exaggerates the stillness, makes it seem only more stark. If he were listening, the man could hear the murmur of the fire in the stove, the creak of the metal roof expanding slightly in the first sunlight, the fall of a spruce cone on the ground outside, but nothing else. Later in the season, soon enough, will come other sounds, the thunder of lightning splitting the sky, spiraling like a snake in the flame on the trunk of a tree, driving a cannonball of fire through the forest carpet of duff debris, the sigh of burning trees, the roar of chaos, but now, nothing. And until next time, this is Bill Kite for Land's Sake on KDNK.